So we're here on Berkeley campus. It's Thursday evening, and there's a big protest going on in the background. In front of Wheeler Hall, some student protesters have locked themselves on the top of a ledge on the fourth story of Wheeler Hall. And there's a big line of riot cops out in front. They've placed metal barricades there. And about 200, 300 protesters in front in support of the people up on the ledge. And the protest is about the budget cuts and the same kind of stuff that they've been fighting for, the student protesters and the workers have been fighting for in the last, you know, year and a half. And we thought we'd take this opportunity to talk with a compañera of ours, Andy Walden, who just came back from Egypt. And she was in Egypt during the revolution that happened in February. So we wanted to talk to Andy about the experience of being there from this perspective that we're working with, the Zapatista perspective, talking about the militarization of society, the army and the police and the power of the protesters in Tahrir Square. So can you tell us a little bit about your experience in general, what you saw there, how long you were there for, and so on?
Well, first off, I arrived there on the evening of February 4th. I got there at night, so I had to sleep in the airport due to the curfew, and when I got in the taxi to come into town, it was actually quite frightening. There was definitely evidence of the community squads that had sort of filled the void of the police. At that time, there were no uniformed police actually out on the streets of Egypt at all. So community members had taken the opportunity to build barricades in front of their neighborhoods and check all the people coming in and out. So definitely saw that. And as we got closer into the city, there were many military checkpoints punctuated with tanks. And that was quite frightening for me, actually. And getting into the city, downtown Cairo, it definitely looked a bit like a war zone. It was completely empty at this time. It was before 7 a.m. And definitely there had been a lot of looting. There were shops all covered in paint so that you couldn't see inside the stores, and there were more community squads there. It was very frightening. But later in the day, getting into the square, definitely was a very different feeling. There was actually quite a bit of celebration going on in the square, singing, dancing, and chanting. So once I found my way around, and the following days, things calmed down, the looting calmed down a lot. It definitely was more of a celebration. Things got to the point where people were just casually coming to the square up until the point when Mubarak left, and then of course, there was celebration there.
We saw, obviously, like all of us have seen the pictures and the footage of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the square. What was it like sort of moving through that space? What kind of relationships were formed there? And then sort of a part of that question is, you know, how were you communicating with people?
Yeah, well, actually, it was quite interesting when you just approached the square. There were a few entrances that were being held by the pro-democracy protesters there. And they had barricades set up, and they were doing civilian checkpoints. You had to show your ID, and they had to check your bag. And, you know, we had women wearing full niqab would pat me down. There was a woman's side and a man's side. But everyone was very friendly. And inside, it was really interesting. Definitely, people took it upon themselves to take care of necessary services. I was really shocked to see the number of hospitals that were created inside the square and actually how sanitary they were. And some of my Egyptian friends there said that the hospitals in Tahrir were way better than the state hospitals themselves. They were better stocked. And it was really wonderful, especially sleeping there in the morning. Of course, people would come by with all sorts of food, you know, and just hand it out to everyone. And one night we didn't have a tent and someone just came up to us and gave us a tent. Blankets were free. So definitely people there were really taking care of each other. It was interesting being an American citizen there. Some people were very welcoming. Some people were pretty paranoid. There was a lot of discussion on state TV of Israeli and American spies. But my Arabic's okay. So we made it through. And definitely I was able to form some pretty great connections with a lot of the Egyptians in the square.
Why do you think people were watching and trusting state TV?
Well, the internet was down. Mubarak cut the internet, so for 2 weeks people didn't have access to anything but the state TV, or of course people who have satellites, which there are many in Egypt. There's a lot of distrust of the Arabic media, actually. Al Jazeera is seen as supporting the Islamists, and a lot of the people in Tahrir weren't necessarily against the Brotherhood, but weren't with them either, and thought that Al Jazeera was, and they're always distrustful of CNN and BBC. So the state TV has been trusted for years, and so people were, unfortunately, listening to that message because they didn't have really anything else to listen to.
So one of the things that seemed apparent from watching, we were watching Al Jazeera here, and it seemed like there was a pretty clear distinction between the way that, it seemed like there were three main different militarized groups. On the one hand, there were the police. On the other hand, there were these sort of paramilitary gangs or thugs that seemed to be aligned with the Mubarak regime. And then there's, of course, the army. And so I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what you saw about the way that those different groups acted and the way that the people in Tahrir Square interacted with them or talked about them or trusted or didn't trust them.
Yeah, well, like I said before, when I first arrived there, there were no uniformed police at all in Egypt. And for some people, this was a huge relief, of course. Others were quite scared because people were afraid of robberies or sexual harassment or things that the police sometimes do try to stop. So I didn't get to see any direct interactions, but people in the square were constantly talking about the police repression. Definitely, there was a huge distinction between the police and the army. And what I did witness was the interactions between the protesters and the pro-Mubarak thugs or gangs. Absolutely, the word on the street there was that these were paid security forces of Mubarak, just dressed in plain clothes. There were IDs that were confiscated from these people that showed that they were security forces. And of course, people there were absolutely terrified of them. But the army, people had a lot of trust in the army, actually, especially after the army said that they wouldn't shoot at the protesters. People kind of saw them more as their protectors. And one of the most interesting things was that after Mubarak stepped down and the army said that they were taking control of the government, in the following days, many, many people, you would see like families bringing their small children and placing them on top of the tanks and taking photos of their kids with, you know, soldiers in the background making peace signs and smiling, you know. People were really, really appreciative of the army. However, you know, a few days following, people tried to remain in the square because they felt like their demands hadn't been fully met, and the army went in and broke it up with the military police also. So it will be interesting to see if those sorts of clashes continue and see if the public opinion of the army changes after those.
Did people talk about the relationship between Mubarak and the military? I mean, clearly the army didn't step in to support his presidency as he was forced out, but I don't know, people expect that?
Well, really, in Egypt for the past 60 years, the major power has been the military. And at that point, really, it didn't make any sense for the army to even support Mubarak, because if he doesn't have the legitimacy of the people and he doesn't have the support of the army, then really he's standing alone. So I think that the army, they know that they're a very, very powerful force, and they know that they could become unpopular with the people, and they would rather save face than, you know, uphold a dictator that they really don't feel has more power than they do in the first place.
And it's interesting because from that perspective, then, in a sense, the revolution, I mean, the pessimistic view would be that the revolution didn't accomplish anything. It just knocked out the figurehead and, you know, the same group of people, the same military leaders are in charge that have been in charge for the last 60 years. I mean, is that more or less your take on it?
Well, really, at this point, we have to wait and see. The army said that they would set up civilian elections within 6 months. So I really don't know at this point, because if they do that, if they do set up, quote unquote, free and fair elections, then maybe the people will continue to support the Army and feel like the Army really did help them. Although, of course, you know, this wouldn't have happened without the pressure of the people either. The Army wasn't going to take Mubarak out anytime soon on their own. So it was the people, absolutely, who pushed this, and the Army did help. But I do believe that the Army will be very reticent to give away their power. And what would be very interesting to see is if there are civilian elections, if there's conflict between the civilian leader, elected civilian leader, and the Army, whether or not the Army would take power against the people if they were also against the elected president.
What changed in Tahrir Square after Mubarak stepped down?
It was a completely different feeling. For me, I felt like being in the square the few nights before Mubarak left, it was definitely a feeling of struggle and solidarity amongst the people. But it wasn't necessarily sad, you know. People were still very lively and upbeat. And afterwards, of course, everyone was celebrating, especially that night. I've never seen so many people on the streets in my entire life. But then the next day, everyone was very, very calm. There were a lot more families. Of course, there were more women and children that came out to the square. But what I found and what I felt was actually a little sad. Of course, I was ecstatic that Mubarak left, but Tahrir wasn't the same anymore, and I honestly feel that what happened in Tahrir is better than anything you would find in Egypt with an elected government. I mean, really, it was people taking care of themselves without security forces, taking care of basic needs and services. And so they sort of, unfortunately, that had to be traded in for an elected government that may not do any of that for the people.
Now, I know you weren't in, you haven't been in Libya, but you've been following the news from sort of the rest of the protests that have been spreading around the Middle East and North Africa. And so it seems like, I mean, obviously the protests and the repression has been much more violent in Libya, for example, and, you know, with the Air Force bombing Libyan citizens, and then some other people defecting, and then there's the presence of these mercenaries. And so I wonder if you could just, I mean, I know it would probably be a little bit speculative, but what would you think, having seen the situation in Egypt, what do you think about the relationship between the sort of militarization of society and the struggle there versus in Libya?
Yeah, well, in Libya, it's a really interesting case because there isn't really an established institutional army like there was in Egypt. Definitely, there are more like pro-Mubarak militias, actually. And so you see only 10 to 12,000 people who are armed supporting Gaddafi. And because of that, of course, they had to bring in mercenaries. And this is an entirely different situation. The mercenaries aren't at all connected to the people, whereas in Egypt, a lot of people have close family members in the army. There were definitely cases where there were brothers on opposite sides of the barricades in Tahrir. So I think definitely people in the military in Egypt could identify with the people in the square a lot more. In Libya, I don't see that as the case, especially with the presence of the mercenaries. And Gaddafi's delusional. I mean, everyone will admit this. And so I'm really interested to see what will happen, because there have been a lot of people defecting from Gaddafi's security forces, and it's really questionable to me how many people still are supporting Gaddafi that aren't being paid high salaries. And I wonder what really is keeping people, quote-unquote, loyal to him.
Okay, this is going to be a cheesy question, but one of the chants that the protesters have been saying out here is from Berkeley to the Middle East, no justice, no peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there are riot cops out here with batons. They've used pepper spray on people. They've hit some people.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about militarization in the U.S.? Maybe, you know, it takes a different form. It takes the form of low-intensity war instead of in-your-face military presence on the streets.
Yeah.
But how is that war carried out?
Well, it's interesting in the U.S. because, of course, there's this rhetoric of democracy and freedom and having personal rights and things like that that have to be upheld. And because of that, it's hard to explicitly militarize and antagonize the people of its country. So definitely it happens much more localized and a lot through the police. And particularly in this protest, you know, it's really interesting to see how they make sure, of course, that as many people disperse as possible through fear. Many people are very afraid of arrest here. And so then what they can do is do small cases of brutality and really terrify people, but at the local level. And most people, unfortunately, here, a lot of the white and upper middle class feel like the police still protect them. So the police aren't seen as this enemy force throughout the country, and a lot of people actually really support the police. So the police are viewed very differently here in the U.S.
On that note, the U.S. government seems really keen on supporting rhetorically the people's struggles in the Middle East, especially in certain countries.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting how the Obama administration was supporting the people of Egypt, but only rhetorically. There wasn't material support at all. And, of course, this is completely different than the entire foreign policy dealing with Mubarak since he's been in office. And, of course, this is because, you know, the U.S. has had great interest in having Egypt as an ally, especially their closest Arab ally when it comes to dealing with Israel. But now we see material support being offered up, the potential of maybe doing a no-fly zone. So that would be material support, and this is because Obama and the administration don't have any real interest in keeping the Gaddafi regime together. They haven't ever been allies. There has been much animosity. So he's willing to offer material support, but if an uprising like what was happening in Egypt or Libya were to happen in the United States, I would be interested to see the rhetorical line that the administration would walk, as they most certainly would suppress that uprising.